morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by a new play, by a new playwright, actually not a new playwright, but new to our air waves, Charles Johnson, whose play in Indian Summer is being staged by Multi-Ethnic Theater through this month, through October, at the Exit Theater studio space on Eddy Street in San Francisco. Good morning, Charles. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm fine. I'm fine. It's so funny, your play, which takes place in the South. Is it, would you say the setting is the setting in Alabama, your hometown? I mean, your native state.
It's my native state. It's just a small town that I just chose not to name, but it could be any small town in Alabama.
Any small town, right. Yeah, you're a native Alabamian, and the small town that we're referencing is Heflin. And after you graduated high school in 1973, you moved to San Francisco, where you were immediately bitten by the acting bug. But I guess you fit that in with your career as a firefighter, huh?
Yes, it fit in very well because, you know, firemen, we worked 9 24-hour shifts a month, so I had some time off to attend acting school, and like you say, I got bit by the bug.
And your stage credits include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Of Mice and Men, and at Multi-Ethnic Theater, Gem of the Ocean, by August Wilson, and that's where I met you on stage in that particular play in one of the roles there. What role were you did you have in Gem of the Ocean?
I played the owner of the house, and his name slips me right now because it's kind of early in the morning. But I played the owner of the house. I played the owner of the house where all the slaves halfway house where all the slaves came through on the Underground Railroad.
Right, right, and you, I think you told me that you were Black Betty's sister. I mean, brother. Sorry, was Black Betty your sister? Okay, yeah. So you played kind of a different kind of role, not necessarily sympathetic to to what was going on in that house.
Yes, that
but Aunt Esther, et cetera.
Yeah, and Aunt Esther. Yeah, that was a very good role. And August Wilson, I'll always jump to his. Jumped to his plays, but when that play started, I got a note from the director, and it made a big difference because I was the owner of that house, which made me have more power than I thought I had, which made the role more interesting to me that I had some power, and just not as an ex-slave, but I had, you know, I owned something, and that made a really big difference in. I mean, preparing for the role. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's sort of you know, thinking of this particular period of August Wilson's 10 play cycle. This is the first play, so people that are coming through Aunt Esther's house, they remember slavery because they might have actually been enslaved, or you know, had been born into slavery around the time when. You know, the Civil War had ended. So there were, you know, a lot of the attitudes that we see in your play, in Indian Summer, are actually present in Gem of the Ocean. So if you could talk about in Indian Summer, the play is, you know, you almost have like plays within the play. You have a white couple, and then you have on the other side of the tracks in the same town, you have and African-American friendship. You have a single man, and that's, what is his last name? Is James?
There's Emmett and Junior.
Right, Junior, right. Yeah, and they're friends, and is it Emmett, the one who's disabled in a wheelchair?
Junior's in the wheelchair. Emmett is his best friend, and it's basically
right.
when you see the play, it's almost like two plays in one. What happens on the white side of town and what happens on in another part of the county on the black side of town. And they, you know, in those days, people, they didn't interact too much unless they had to. As you see in the play, they only interact when they're at work or at the very end of the play when they have to interact with each other. So it's kind of two plays in one. So you get both views as to what's going on in that period of time.
Right, yeah. And it's really interesting because Charlie Ray, played by Kevin Wesney, and his wife Pearl, played by A.J. Davenport, he's just getting out of prison after being in, like he went in and then he got out and then he went back in because he's got a brother, Bobby, I believe.
Yes, Bobby.
Played by Paul Rodriguez, who is always talking him into some really illegal and not well thought out scrapes. And so he's a frustrated blues artist. And so it's so funny when, you know, the director, you know, Lewis, introduces, Lewis Campbell, he always says that, you know, he wants people to see that a black man wrote this play.
Yeah,
because
because
you flip it. You don't have, like, the stereotypical black man, you know, blues as a blues singer and also a black former convict or, you know, former prisoner. So this tells a little bit about sort of the, you know, where the idea for the play came from and why, you know, why did you want to mix it up and not make it so stereotypical and something that people have seen on stage and in film, you know, with different twists, of course, over and over and over again?
Yes, just I was, you know, that came about. I just chose to go into this thing through the eyes of white people, and me being a black writer, and sometimes it's very hard, especially in San Francisco, for black writers to get a quote-unquote black play on stage. And so I decided to flip the script and see it through the eyes of white people. And as you know, in the play, most of the actors are white except the two old brothers, Emmett and Junior. Mm-hmm. And Lewis said, well, Charles, I want him to know that a black man wrote this now because it's kind of different. And I said, yes, and that's how I wanted to bring it to the stage and let them see that, you know, how it looks through the eyes of white people as they view black people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I decided to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and the play, you know, set, you know, as we already mentioned, in a small town in Alabama in 1980, so that's pretty recent. And the two men, Emmett and Junior, Emmett portrayed by Fabian Hurd and Junior portrayed by Benny Lewis, whom, you know from stage ensembles, so and also maybe some of the other characters, other actors too. So this is a real ensemble piece. But what's really wonderful about, you know, Emmett and Junior is the scene when the stage actually shifts, because there are actually two stages. You know, we have the scene where the white family and their relatives get together, and then the stage turns, physically is turned, and then where Junior and Emmett meet, usually often on, you know, Junior's porch, and they talk, and it's a whole other scene there, but it's the same town. And it's really wonderful, the camaraderie, you know, and the love that we see between these two black men, and that's not something anyone sees enough of. And I want you to talk a little bit about those relationships, and were those relationships that you pulled on from your own youth, you know, growing up in the South, or, you know, seeing your father or your uncles or, you know, older men, you know, sharing that kind of relationship with one another. And now as an adult man yourself, you know, sort of pulling on relationships like that that you share with other men.
Yes. My dad was a minister in the South. And he had this one friend. I admired their relationship. I never seen anything like it. I mean, they were like more than brothers. I mean, when they saw each other, they hugged. They laughed, and they used to always wrestle each other. They'd actually wrestle each other on the ground, grown men. And that's where I got that relationship from, because it's very hard, like you said, it's very hard to have those relationships in this day and time. How everybody's after everybody, and nobody trusts anybody. But that's where I got that relationship from my father and his friend. I used to see it all the time, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna put this in a play. Mm-hmm. And that's how that came to be.
Right, yeah. Your father was a real civil rights activist. He had you all, you and your sister, integrating schools. And we were talking about that a little bit before I saw the play, you know, before the curtain went up a couple of weeks ago, and I'm always just really in awe and marvel at the bravery and the courage of children who were able to go into these hostile situations. So I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your integrating in elementary school and your sister being the only black child in the community, the white community's high school.
Yeah, that came about in my small town. I think the whites, it was going to be forced integration coming soon. And I think they wanted to get ahead of it to avoid forced integration. They thought they could stop it. So the white ministers got together and they came to my dad's house. You know, and being a black minister in the South, you know how they court the churches when they want some political stuff to happen. And they talked my dad into, well, hey, you know, since this thing is going to happen, why don't your kids start it off? And so the first year they sent my sister to the high school, and there was another black guy that was with her, but he couldn't take it, and he quit. And in our family, quitting wasn't an option, so she had to stick it out the whole year by herself, the only black in the school. And then the next year, my dad said, it's your turn. And, you know, I had all my friends. We're playing football. We're doing all this stuff. But then I got stuck in this white school with another friend of mine named Howard Prothrow. And Howard, he couldn't take it, and he dropped out and left me there all by myself during the whole year. You know, and that year was pretty hard because, you know, I was a A student, and then when that happened, I dropped down to D's and C's, and my parents couldn't understand why. But I was, you know, being harassed every day, name calling, you know, being punched, kicked every day. And I remember one time when the government officials come around to check the schools for accreditation and everything, and I remember the teacher, Mr. Howell, had me and Howard Protho get up in front of the school, in front of the class, rather, and sing Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread. And that was really tough. That was really tough. But we stuck it out. I mean, I stuck it out that whole year. And the next year, they were forced to integrate, and they closed the black school, and they brought all the blacks down to where I was. And that was a godsend, because at least I had some friends, somebody to, you know, to talk to, someone to, you know, to help me out as, you know, as this thing was going on. But it was really hard time for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I was wondering out loud about the trauma of going into this, you know, hostile territory and its effects on you as a child. You mentioned your grades going from A's to D's, and then you said that your sister, she was so disappeared that she was not even included in the senior class photo, and you all had to, your family had to sue the school district to get them to retake the photo.
Yes, because in the hallway they had class of this year. When the photo came out, my sister's picture was not in there. And being that my sister lived in out here in San Francisco, you know, we got an attorney and forced them to add her picture to that class of whatever year it was that she was in school. Yeah, but it took the courts to make them put that her picture up there, because they did not want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So you're talking about recently that this happened, right?
No.
And this is like after your sister has graduated and grown up and gone on and moved.
Well, this,
to
this happened
state?
A couple of years after she graduated. I think she graduated in 1970. 71, and I graduated in 1973.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, wow. So your sister moved to San Francisco. What was it about San Francisco that called you all here?
Well, as you know, a lot of blacks came to San Francisco to work in the shipyards, and her husband, my sister's husband, he was in the Army, mm-hmm. Air Force, and he was stationed out here. And after he got out of the Air Force, he started working at the shipyards. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you could go to college, City College, if you were a resident, for a year, and you could go to college for free. And she said, look, this is a great opportunity for you to go to college. Just come out here and, you know, become a resident, and you can go to college for free. And that's exactly what I did. I came out here and went to City College and graduated in 1976. In 1979, I became a San Francisco firefighter.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah. So do you still have nightmares about, you know, what happened to you as a youngster in that one year when you were the sole black kid in the school? And you mentioned your sister has some residual trauma around that year she was in high school, 'cause she not only was she an African American in that in that environment, she's also a girl.
Yes. Yes. She's still traumatized by it. I see some of the things that she goes to. She doesn't trust a lot of people. And I always tend to, you know, look at the fabric of America, because it's always, you know, it's always, to me, it's not always a black and white issue. And it took me a long time to get my head back screwed back on, right? Because it was just, even in the San Francisco Fire Department, there was racism. In the police department, there was racism. And in the fire department, there was one incident where I saved some people in 87, and they printed a photo, and they whited me out. The only thing that was left in the photo was my legs. It was a front-page story back in 87, and it's also in Life magazine. And I had to go through some treatment in order to get rid of that, some of it, you know, because it just eats away and eats away and eats away at you, and then after a while, it's just too much. And now I'm better, but like I say, I'm always cautious. I'm always watching and seeing, you know, being aware of what's going on around me, and with you know, especially with race issues. Yes, so yeah.
Yeah, and also you can get back at, you know, sort of our society that makes these kind of situations untenable through your writing. I mean, you can write the story, you know, write other stories, you know, create other characters, which is a really wonderful way to sort of change things up and make people think about things in another way. And I think we're joined in the studio by one of the members of the cast. Is that you, AJ?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Oh, good morning, AJ. AJ Davenport plays Pearl, and Pearl is Charlie Ray's wife, and wow, what a job you have in convincing us that you love him.
Well, Kevin himself is very lovable, and Charlie Ray,
yes.
you know, Charlie Ray's not the easiest man to love, but I guess what their relationship really shows is, you know, every pot has a lid. You find the person that you think is going to complete you. And Pearl, in a lot of ways, is like a lot of other people. She will do whatever she has to do to stay with this man she loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's definitely a woman who really supports, you know, her partner, her husband. And this is your... I'm trying to read your bio. You are a member of MET and Custom Made Theater, and this is your seventh show, so you're a veteran.
I am. I really enjoy working with Lewis. He's given me some amazing opportunities, and I really love the ensemble he has produced, not only for this show, but he is truly a director who knows how to put together an incredible ensemble. And make every actor aware of how important they are in that ensemble and give them chances that a lot of other directors simply wouldn't do because of race or ability or size or age. He has an approach to casting unlike anyone I've ever seen. I wouldn't call it colorblind. I'd call it color creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about, you know, Pearl and why you wanted to portray her in this this story, An Indian Summer. And this definitely is a warm play. I mean, people are, you know, that little tiny fan gets a lot of use on top of the refrigerator.
Yeah, it barely makes a dent in the heat in the theater, I will tell you that. It is interesting to do a play about a hot Indian summer when San Francisco is going through its Indian summer, when it is 70 degrees outside and about 80 in the theater. I met Charles through Lewis, and I had seen a play that was produced here called Ain't It So a few years ago. And when I first started meeting with Charles, he said, you know, I'm working on this play, and I'd really like you to play the lead. And having seen some of his shows, I was like, oh, well, I'd be honored. And then when we, about a year and a half ago, when we started reading through it, I got even more excited. I was really, really honored and really looking forward to this run, and it has been an amazing production and an amazing experience for me, and I think for most of the other actors in the cast as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Charles, so what do you think? Were you thinking about AJ when you were creating this character, and why did you think that she'd be perfect for the role of Pearl, Charlie Ray's partner?
When I first saw her, and it was a play she was doing called Red Rider, and she had this character in there, and that character reminded me of the character that I was writing about in my play, and when I met her, and we started talking about it, I said, you know what, I got something for you. And I want you to play the lead role, and I'm going to write it all around you. Because I know she could pull it off. I've seen her work. She's a total professional. And I said, you know, because it takes a special, I think it takes a special person to pull off this role and courage to pull off this role. As I said, you know, these people, that they're, you know, they're straight up racist people. And for her to step in and do what she does in this role is just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, what I really like, AJ, is that your character Pearl, she's got a subtle bigotry, because she works at the courthouse. She knows things are changing, so you can't just be all, you know, upfront with what you're thinking. Yet overriding anything around ethics or, you know, a sense of fair dealing, you know, it's the love for Charlie Ray. So whatever Charlie Ray wants, which he wants, you know, to get his break, you know, to be able to go to the studio and produce, you know, a sample?
A demo tape.
Right. So that he could, you know, get out there and be on the radio show and have tours and things like that. So she really surprises me. You know, with the ends that she'll go to. I mean, really creative ends, but illegal, to help him get what he... Yeah, and then you know, we hear about... You really, you know, wrote a really complex character, Charles, in Pearl, because she's a loving woman who has taken a whole lot from Charlie Ray, including spousal abuse, and has forgiven him. And you wonder, like, why? But then, I don't know, maybe there's not a lot of, you know, men to choose from. But then, you know, love is blind and love is forgiving. And love, you know, has, you know, people go to a lot, you know, to take a whole lot when they say they love someone. And maybe she really sees him as transformed. I'm not certain because I, you know, he's not my man. But anyway.
I think Pearl wants to believe the best about Charlie Ray. She wants everyone to see him the way she does. And she is willing to forgive a lot. But I think she's also indicative of a lot of women who who stay with men who abuse them because that's what their lives were modeled on. They saw that abuse in their families, and it was passed down to them, and they don't know any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I agree with you that Pearl is an amazing, complex character, and I absolutely love playing her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then we juxtapose Charlie with Bobby, his brother, his big brother, and or older brother, and then we juxtapose Pearl with Sarah. Sarah is her sister-in-law, and it really gets more complicated, if anything.
Yes.
So I want both of you all to take a few moments to talk about this relationship. AJ, you could talk about it as Pearl's, being involved with these, you know, the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law, and how the sister-in-law feels about Pearl. Does Pearl know that Sarah feels about her the way she does? Bree Swartwood does a really wonderful job, you know, as Sarah, and then again, Paul Rodriguez as this Bobby. You know, he's like, oh, we just want to squash him with our foot. Oh, I do anyway.
I remember.
Like,
I remember the night you came to the theater, and you were sitting there, and you were talking to yourself. And you said, "How in the hell can she like him? Why did she marry him? Why did she want anything to do with that guy?" That was kind of funny. Oh boy.
For Bree, I mean, she does an amazing job, and Sarah really kind of morphed as Charles continued to work on the script, and it's a real testament to Charles that he was able to make her a complex character. And I think at first she isn't sure how she feels about Pearl, but through the time of the play she begins to understand Pearl and genuinely care about Pearl, and that comes across, and I think Pearl definitely loves Sarah as best she can. They support each other, and that they both need each other. And when things start to fall apart, they find strength in one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about that brother-in-law?
Well, you know, Bobby, he's just bad to the bone. That's all there is to it. And Pearl sees that, but she doesn't see it in Charlie Ray, because she'd be a lot happier if Bobby were just not in the picture.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. Well, let's give our audience the details so they can come see the play. So, what's the run? I know it's tonight and tomorrow, but how many more weekends can people come see the play at the Exit Theater Studio Space, 156 Eddy Street in San Francisco?
Well, unfortunately, this is the last weekend.
Oh no!
Yes, this is the last weekend, but there's a strong possibility we will try to bring it back next year. We're still working out some details, but there's a strong possibility it will come back next year, and I'm sure, you know, we will let you know all the information when and if that does happen.
Okay.
But, yes, tonight and tomorrow night is the last two nights, and if you want to see it, there might be a few tickets left, so go to the website and try to get your ticket.
Or you could always just show up at the door and beg to be let in.
Yeah, we got some seats.
Yeah,
show up at the door.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the play goes up at 8:00 tonight, Friday, October 18th, and then tomorrow, Saturday, October 19th, 8:00. And again, it's 156 Eddy Street. Really easy to get to. You just get off at Powell Street Bar Station and just walk up the stairs and walk up the street. It's very, very close. Is Bart on strike?
Bart is on strike.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Well, you got to drive now. Are the buses not on strike, or are they on strike too?
Muni is still running, they do come to the Powell Street BART station. Public transportation is always a great option in San Francisco.
Yeah. There are a lot of garages around, though, but you definitely don't want to miss an Indian summer. It's a wonderful, wonderful sojourn into a world that I don't think a lot of people visit often enough, particularly looking at these various perspectives. And, AJ, what do you think when you finally meet this old guy that you've been looking at swindling?
Well, Benny and I have worked together on many occasions, and but it's just so much fun to be backstage and listen to the banter between him and Fabian as Junior and Emmett. I think what Pearl feels is that she finally realizes that that these people that all of her life she's thought of as less than human are human, and they have feelings, and what she did was wrong. And I think she truly tries to set things right, but it's a little bit too late for that to happen.
Right. Yeah, the way you wrote that, Charles, is just really marvelous, because it's just sort of an open-ended kind of conclusion. You know, and it also is a lesson that, you know, when you do something wrong, you have to hold that and work it out. You can't give it away. You know, you can't give away the wrongdoing and hope that everything will work itself out in that instance well, I don't know if you would call it atonement. What would you call it, AJ?
Well,
when she tries to fix
that,
it.
Well, I think she does try to atone, but that lesson for her is that just because she says she's sorry doesn't mean anything changed. And as long as we hold on to those preconceived notions of who other people are or who we think they are, that none of us are ever really free when we judge people based on their race or their gender or any of the things that separate us as people. You just have to realize that under everything else, we're all human. We all make mistakes and need to learn from those mistakes.
And also, too, in the lines in Pearl's some of her lines is when she tells the old guy, the old black man, that when you've lost everything that you've dreamed for and it's all gone, you know, and there's no reason for me to do this anymore. She had this epiphany after she read the scriptures, and all her hopes and dreams are gone, and it's just like, what am I going to do with this now? That, you know, it just isn't worth doing anymore, and that's when you see the humility in Pearl. And actually, I've seen people in the audience, they start having feelings for Pearl, because she has somewhat seen the light, if for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what's in that scripture, does it talk about light?
Yeah, okay, go ahead, OJ, you take it away.
Not particularly light, but there's a light metaphor in God showing you the right way to live your life and the right way to go forward. Mm-hmm. And so she is being led by something. But it's too bad she didn't come to it earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
It saves a lot of people a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really strong, strong work. Thank you so much, Charles, for writing this play and AJ for taking on that tough role of Pearl, because it takes a real strong actress to be able to elicit empathy, you know, from the audience about a character, you know, who up to the point where things kind of fall apart is, you know, one would feel deserving of everything that happens. it's just such a great play. So I really encourage everyone to get out and see it on, you know, you know, in his premiere at the Exit Theater studio space. as opposed to, I mean, you know, it's going to come back, but it's not quite the same thing when things come back. You want to see it on the first run and then go see it again. Say, oh, yeah, you know. So I would certainly encourage everyone to try to get to one of these final two performances. And thank you both so much
thank
for joining
you.
Us on the air today.
Thank you.
Oh, you're
thank
welcome. You take good care. Oh, and you mentioned the website, Charles. What's the website?
We Have Met. One word. We Have Met, MET.org.
Okay, cool. Super. You take good care.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. We're speaking to Minister, Dr. Dorsey Blake, who is going to be telling us about the 18th Annual Howard Thurman Convocation, 69th Church Anniversary. Wow, how phenomenal. That is so wonderful. And you're going to be honoring two sisters, Dr. Angela
yes.
Y. Davis and Dr. Fanya Davis. And you're going to have special musical guests, Pope Flynn and Wakanda Mwetu Choir and Dr. Curl Blake. It's going to be really phenomenal. Maybe you could tell us, Dorsey, about the Howard Thurman Convocation. You've inducted and honored so many fabulous people over the past 18 years. I mean, the list is just like, oh, my gosh, really?
Yes, yes. It has been quite impressive. In addition to honoring these two marvelous sisters, we call it a different Sisters Act, Angela Davis. And we've honored in the past people like Leslie Feinberg, who was head of the one of the leaders in the transgender movement, Nelson Johnson, who worked with the Communist Party in North Carolina. Dr. Jeremiah Wright has been honored, Dr. Geoffrey Smith, Reverend Cecil Williams. In fact, Danny Glover and Barbara Lee have also been honored, Sister Barney Galvin, who started Religious Witness with Homeless People. Robert Reese from our own church was recognized. Dr. Bob Scott for his work with AIDS. So we've just had and Chaplain Yee, who was the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo, who discovered what was happening to some of the Muslim prisoners and blew the whistle on that. So we've had an array of outstanding people who have received the Howard Thurman Award. And the award is given for to people who in some way sort of embody what Dr. Thurman's life was really committed to in terms of the search for common ground, being inclusive and speaking up for those who've been marginalized or disinherited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So tell our audience about Dr. Thurman, whom established the Church for the Fellowship of All People in San Francisco 69 years ago. Is that correct?
That's right. In 1944. And what I will say is he established it. He and Dr. Fisk, there were two ministers. Dr. Fisk was a professor at San Francisco State College at that time and was a professor there and also a Presbyterian minister. And he had the idea, along with some other people, some visionary folks, that it was time to integrate the church because at that time all the churches in the United States were segregated. And so a small group of people met, and they had this idea of forming a different kind of church. And they contacted Dr. Thurman, who was also quite interested in the same idea. He had visited Mahatma Gandhi in 1936. There was a pilgrimage from 35 to 36 to India, Ceylon, and Burma. And in India, he met with Mahatma Gandhi. And in that encounter, they talked about, you know, nonviolence and people working together and so on. As he was leaving, going through the Khyber Pass, he had a vision of these tradespeople from various countries going through the pass and so on. And he had an idea of having a religious fellowship where people from all walks of life could come together and have profound spiritual experiences. And he felt that if that happened over a significant time period, that there would develop this sense of common ground for which he was searching, a sense of common ground which would undercut all the barriers by which we lived, all the labels, race, class, these kinds of things. So the church was built on the idea we want people from diverse backgrounds to come. And we try to celebrate that by not only talking about Christianity, Judaism. We have a Native American person who comes in on a regular basis. We've had Hindu speakers, Muslim speakers, Jewish speakers. It's to try to help people to understand the various paths people have chosen to find, to come into fulfillment and to find their union with the cosmos. So Dr. Thurman was actually born in 1899. If you look on most of his literature, you will see the birth date listed as November 18th, 1900. But he found out later on in life that it was actually 1899 because he remembered that as a child, people used to call him a Saturday child. You know, we use astrology here like he's a Libra or whatever. People in those days would sometimes say, well, he's a September child or he's a Saturday child. And he kept saying, but Saturday 1900 did not fall. November the 18th, 1900 did not fall on a Saturday. And he found a perpetual calendar, and he discovered that November the 18th did fall on a Saturday in 1899. So we presume that was really the year that he was born. And he died April the 10th, 1981. Again, the Fellowship Church was the first church that was really interracial and interfaith. Dr. Thurman was also the first black person to be the dean of chapel at a major white theological seminary, and that was Boston University. And his first year there was Martin Luther King's last year, really, a residency. They knew each other. Dr. Thurman and Martin Luther King's father were in Morehouse at the same time, and Mrs. King knew Mrs. Thurman, King's mother. They knew each other from Baptist circles, and I think they went to high, and they went to high school together. So Martin Luther King would come over, and they talk about his coming over for to discuss the World Series or to see the World Series. And Mrs. Thurman actually talked with Martin Luther King about coming to Fellowship Church at the time to as minister. This was like many years after, some years after Dr. King had left. But the point is that Dr. Thurman then and Fisk exchanged correspondence, and Thurman decided to come out himself to be the co-minister of the church. So that was 1944. You must remember, again, 1944, again, everything was segregated. Interracial marriages were forbidden, even in the liberal state of California. And this was 1 year before the United Nations came into being. It is also quite interesting because Eleanor Roosevelt, there was a dinner given for the Thurmans who left Howard University to come to California to start the church. Eleanor Roosevelt was a speaker there and was one of the first people to sign on as, at that time, associate member at large. And Eleanor Roosevelt was also quite involved with the establishment of the United Nations. So this was, again, a real breakthrough. And Thurman was trying to find a place, a church, that could be there for the people who were engaged in social reality, social change, social transformation, where they could come to a place where on Sunday they could get retooled, rejuvenated, renewed, and understand that their efforts were connected to larger efforts, to the Spirit of God, to the all-pervading presence, to bring about a newness among the people, a sense of common ground, or what Martin Luther King would call the beloved community.
Wow, wow. Oh, that's what a marvelous backdrop. Wow, I mean, you know.
He was the author of some 20-some books dealing with spirituality. And the other interesting thing is the church building itself was built by, in 1906, I'm sorry, right before the earthquake. And it was built by Gustav Niebuhr. Well, Reinhold Niebuhr and H. Richard Niebuhr were some of the outstanding theologians of the past century. So the church building has that history also, that it was actually built by the congregation of the father of Reinhold and H. Richard Niebuhr.
Wow, wow. Yeah, and you were installed, officially installed, although you had been, you had served as minister for 2 years prior to your installation.
Yes.
In October 1944, so you're having a big anniversary.
1994,
next year.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Mrs. Sue Bailey Howard Thurman presented Dr. Thurman's robe, which had been worn since Dr. Thurman's death, to you as a symbol of her trust in your leading the congregation. And there's a quote, so that there will be no past greater than our future. And
yes.
And you've been there ever since, sort of hold us down, as they say.
Yes. And that was quite a service. It totally wiped me out to have that robe placed on me, because it had not been worn since his death. And I could really feel his essence. And I just ended up in, I think the whole congregation was on the verge of tears. And there were some tears actually flowing, because it was a very significant moment.
And recently, Dr. Thurman's daughter made her transition, right?
Yes, last year. There was the elder daughter, Olive.
Yes.
The younger daughter died a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more Thurmans still with us?
Yes. You mentioned Olive, who transitioned last year. Her daughter, Emily. And Emily has a son, Philip. And Olive also had a son, Anton, who lives in New York, and he has children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
And Anne had a child, Suzanne, and she is in this area, too. So there's still some folks from the Thurman family left.
Mm-hmm. That's great, yeah. I just don't know how, you know, looking at fellowshipsf.org, just looking under this section on leadership, and just wondering, like, how do you do all these things that you do? I mean, you're dean of faculty and visiting professor of spirituality and prophetic justice at Star King School for the ministry, and that's I don't know, is it an association with UC Berkeley?
Yes, at the PhD level, at the doctoral level,
right.
Star King School for the Ministry, along with the other seminaries, a part of the GTU, at the doctoral level, there is a connection with UC Berkeley. The genius of that GTU, though, is that if you're at Star King School for the Ministry, where I am, or at American Baptist Seminary of the West, or Pacific School of Religion, whatever, you can take classes anywhere in the GTU. And so you have this wonderful mixture of people coming from all backgrounds. And now there's also a center for Jewish studies, Buddhist studies, Islamic studies. So it's quite a rich environment for those who really are serious about religion and its place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I'm there. I'm part-time now, and I stepped down as dean about a couple years ago maybe. So that has taken a little bit of from some activities, but still it is quite demanding. I have a wonderful co-minister, Dr. Catherine Benton, and we have a small but very committed board and fellowship. So it's a joy being there. And we're just so pleased that both Angela Davis and Fania Davis agreed to be honored because they have just been outstanding. I think people know a lot about Angela, and Fania, too, has just been remarkable, especially in terms of her restorative justice work with young people.
So what happens at the convocation? Because I haven't made one yet.
What happens at the convocation? It's really an afternoon where we really ask people to set aside some time to be with us in community. For example, what will happen Sunday is that my brother, Dr. Carl Blake, who is a concert musician and has concertized not only nationally but internationally, he will begin with a prelude and play some spirituals. And then we have Pope Flynn. I don't know if you've ever heard Pope play the drums, but Pope is just incredible. He's from Ghana, and he's a master drummer, so he will then do something to bring us together, the call to assembly. Then we have a music, invocation, acknowledgement, those kinds of things. And then we'll have Dr. Angela Davis to speak. And we also have Vukani, as you mentioned, Vukani Mwetu Choir there. They'll be singing. And both Drs. Angela Davis and Dr. Fania Davis will speak. And then later on we present them with the Howard Thurman Award. After the program's over, we will have a reception, a wonderful reception. So we invite people to linger at Fellowship Church and have some food with us. That is actually one of the very strong points about the church also, is that we really do encourage people to be in community and to talk. So quite often people at Fellowship Church, if the service gets over at 12, 15 or whatever, often people at the church for another couple of hours because people do sit around and talk and get to know each other, trying to find out really in a profound way what's happening in people's lives. And it's just remarkable the kind of time that people do spend together after the service. So we'll have a reception, and we hope that that will give people a chance to meet each other, meet and greet, and learn a little bit about who's gathered there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why don't you tell our audience, you know, sort of where the Church for the Fellowship of All People is located, and the program starts at 3 p.m. There's no morning service on this Sunday.
Yeah.
And as you say, it starts at 3, and then, you know, you plan to spend some time. It's really when you were mentioning about how people talk to each other afterwards, that the whole idea of fellowship is an active part of the ministry, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Dr. Thurman actually felt that one of the reasons we had so many problems in this world is the fact that there are too many contacts without fellowship, and that can lead to ill will. It can lead to, and finally ends up leading to hatred, because you have contact but there's no fellowship, and so it's very critical for the fellowship to occur. And the way the fellowship occurs is by having people to linger with each other for a while. And get to really know each other, to bring their full selves to the encounter.
Yeah.
So, yes, the fellowship is extremely important. And, in fact, somebody has sort of joked that, which is true, actually, that you may be able to mess with the worship service, but don't mess with their fellowship hour at Fellowship Church, because people are really used to it.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what the location then?
The location. Let me give you all the Howard Thurman. This is the 69th anniversary of the church and 18th annual Howard Thurman Convocation. It is going to be this coming Sunday, October 20th, 3 o'clock. The address is 2041 Larkin Street, San Francisco, 2041 Larkin Street. That's between Vallejo and Broadway. It's right through the tunnel, near the tunnel in Chinatown. And if you need more information, you can email info@fellowshipsf.org. That's info@fellowship.org. Go to the website, www.fellowshipsf.org, or phone us at 415-776-4910. 415-776-4910.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're going to have wonderful entertainment.
Okay.
And, yes.
is everything cool with regards to the phone number? 415-776-4910. Okay.
Yes.
I was just sort of scrolling down on your illustrious academic preparation and work, and I remember when we first met, you were the director for the Center for Urban Black Studies at the
Yes.
Theological Union and core faculty member at the GTU.
Yes.
And also you were a part of the University of Creation Spirituality.
Yes.
The VP for the community learning aspect of that program, because I'm a graduate of Holy Names College.
Yes.
Then now university, where it was started, and then it moved, you know, to
Yes.
downtown Oakland. And I just, you know, thought it was really great the way, you know, you were really active in, you know, making sure that there was a black male presence, you know, in the in the theology tradition, because you don't see a lot of black men, particularly in the leadership. And then I was reading, you know, that you were the first full-time black male professor at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa in 1972 to 77. And the person I was speaking to before you came on, he's a playwright, and he's Charles Johnson, and he's a native Alabamian. And he was born and raised in the small town of Heflin.
Oh, I need to contact him. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those were interesting days. In fact, I reflected a lot on that recently because of the 50th anniversary of not only the March on Washington, but the bombing of the little girls.
Yes.
Alabama. And I actually also worked at 16th Street Baptist Church for a year, which is where the little girls
were. You did?
Yes.
Oh, my
goodness.
10 years
later. So I actually met the parents of three of the girls. Yes.
Mm.
So So it was really, I had to do that. My first Sunday in Alabama, I said I had to pay tribute to what had happened. So my first Sunday, I drove from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to Birmingham, which is about 52 miles, and went to the service there at 16th Street, and really enjoyed the service, and later became a part of the team there, the ministerial team, for a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, one of my, you know, the Rosa Parks, her centennial birth is this year, and the anniversary of her passing is October 24th next week. And I was talking to one of my colleagues at College of Alameda, and she grew up in Detroit, you know, where Mrs. Parks, you know, continued her work and her activism, political activism, you know, through the offices of Congressman Conyers to a large extent, but outside of that as well. And and she was talking about how she had heard an interview with the sister of one of the young women who was killed in that bombing 50 years ago. I think it was September 15th was the anniversary.
Yeah.
And she was in the bathroom or something, and I think she lost one of her eyes or something. But anyway, she was, you know, disfigured, but also traumatized from that, and so she was doing really well in school, had aspirations to do something really big with her life, and ended up being a domestic worker to date. I mean, she still works in people's homes.
Mm.
And I was just wondering, I know you've spoken about it, and sort of just looking at sort of the trauma of the civil rights movement. I mean, that's a war. These people, I mean, when people say veterans of the civil rights movement, that's not just a, you know, sort of a euphemism. They really are veterans. That was a war, and then on top of that, we've got the trauma of enslavement, which was really closer to, you know, the parents and the grandparents of these children that were going in on the front lines doing these real heroic missions.
Oh yes, right. You're right, the civil rights movement was really a war, and it's amazing because the people who were on the front lines to a great extent also were as disciplined as soldiers were, because they had to go through nonviolent training. And it was more difficult, I think, in being that kind of war than maybe one where there's violence, because how do you absorb all the violence that's been meted out towards you without retaliating? How do you withstand the brutality, the names? And, for example, when you looked at what happened in Birmingham, the fire hoses and so on, how do you absorb all of that without striking back in some kind of way? That, to me, is extraordinary. But, yes, it has been a war, and a lot of people have been traumatized from various racial groups. Many of the white folks who were in coalition with black folks, and then when they returned, or many of them were thrown out of churches or lost their jobs, and that led to trauma also. It is just amazing what has happened in terms of what happened during the civil rights movement, and we haven't taken adequate time to assess its impact on people in terms of their own moral understanding, in terms of the ethics, in terms of their soul and their minds. We have not done that.
Yeah. I'm really interested in, you know, sort of the work of, like these you know, these young people, a lot of them were very young, on the front lines. You know, you think about, you know, the young people that Mrs. Parks worked with.
Baker, yes. They were very young.
Ella Baker, yeah. And then you think about the person I was speaking to just before you, Charles Johnson. He and a friend integrated the public school in his town, but his friend couldn't take it, and he dropped out. And Charles, who was an A student, ended up, you know, at the end of that school year, being a D student because of all of the trauma that he experienced. And before that, his sister, the year before, she was in her senior year in high school, integrated the white high school, and both of them, you know, were traumatized after that experience and left the South, came to the West Coast to live. You know, Charles, when he grew up, his sister came out here first, you know, with her husband, who was in the Air Force, I believe, he said. But you know, I don't think enough attention is paid to sort of these war veterans. I mean, this you know, that this was a war, and taking care of these veterans.
Well, as you talk about what happened in this college, it would be amazed. Some of you would be amazed at some of the questions that were asked of black students in certain classes, biology or so on, basically to force them out of the pre-med program or whatever. You know, like who produces most rapidly, rabbits, blah, 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 or Negroes, that kind of thing that you have to face as a black student. A lot of the things I had to do then, back then, was really to try to help black students understand that a lot that was happening to them was not their fault, but was part of the racism of the system, and to try to advocate for them, because there are a lot of things that happen to black students that a lot of people don't understand. And one of the reasons, in fact, while I was at the University of Alabama, I went to Atlanta for a conference and the Institute of the Black World, and I was asked there why I was at the white school, because I should be at a black school, whatever. And I said, well, number one, the black school offered me a contract. The University of Alabama did. And I told them at that point, I said, there are 400 black students at the University of Alabama and nobody there to mentor them, to be with them. I said, you know, one of the advantages of the black schools, black colleges, is that you have black faculty and staff there to be of support. I said, that's not true of these students at the University of Alabama. So they actually need somebody there on whom they can call and on whom they can depend to advocate for them in the halls of power, where we have access to those halls of power at the university. But, yeah, they had to go through a lot. They were in many ways degraded. But it's amazing that so many survived and survived so well with their spirits intact and still hopeful people and people who were able to achieve. But, yes, the trauma was there also.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my author addresses that too, the whole trauma. And the fact that we have to heal that trauma before we can move forward as a community.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Are you native San Franciscan? Because I noticed that you got your AB from Brown University, MA and MDiv from Pacific School of Religion, which is here,
right,
and Doctorate of Ministry from the United Theological Seminary, and I think that's here too. Is that here?
No, that's in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio.
That's Ohio. Okay. Yeah, so where do you hail from?
I'm from Kansas City. I was Missouri.
Oh, okay.
Kansas City, Missouri, and my father was a minister. He was his first church, called to his first church when I was about 8 months old, and so we moved to a little town called Liberty, Missouri, and that's where I grew up. Over 14 years, and then when I was 15, we moved to Kansas City again, back to Kansas City, where my father was the pastor of the Highland Baptist Church. And then we moved to Omaha after I graduated. The same summer I graduated from high school, the family moved to Omaha, Nebraska, and was there for many years. And then, well, we were all then. By that time, the kids were all grown. But then they moved to Meridian, Mississippi, and back to Memphis, where they were from originally.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm from Kansas City, and like Dr. Smith, Geoffrey Smith Sr. is from Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so would you say Kansas City, I mean, it's a city, but would you say that there's the southern kind of, is there a southern, you know, sort of what was going on in the south, is that also Kansas City, or are you?
Kansas City is more Midwestern, you know, although I certainly grew up, the first 6 years of my life were, in terms of school, were spent in a segregated school, Garrison School in Liberty.
Uh-huh.
So then we integrated, the first integration in that place came through Little League Baseball. And then at the end of at the end of the sixth grade, the schools did integrate. So I spent seventh, eighth, and ninth grades in desegregated schools in Liberty. And then again, we moved to Kansas City. And to where I went to Lincoln High, and Lincoln was almost 100% black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. What a nice name, Liberty. That's a great name.
Yeah, it was funny because there was a Japanese woman, Mrs. Takahashi, she was of German descent, but her husband's Japanese, and she actually joined our church, a black church in Liberty, Missouri, and she was actually, the white folks got so upset with her that she was actually run out of town. And so I said that she had to move to the periphery of Liberty. So she was out on the outskirts of Liberty.
Wow. Well, we'll have to have you on again to talk some more about just sort of, you know, the need for a spiritual center in one's life, and the work of Dr. Thurman and the wonderful work you all are doing at, you know, your church that Dr. Thurman founded, the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples. And folks definitely need to make it out on Sunday at 3 p.m. for
Thank
the 18th
you.
Convocation and the 89th year of this wonderful institution in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it's a free event.
It's a free event. We will ask you for – we will pass the collection plate, and we'll ask you if you can to give a nice donation, because it is also our main fundraiser for the year. And our building is over 100 years old, and so that it needs some help and care, and we had to put a new roof on it. So we are hoping also that people will be generous in their donations, but there is no fee. It's left up to the individual to give what the individual can. Now, if for those who are not familiar, again, this is Larkin Street between Broadway and Vallejo. I think it's 2041 Larkin Street. And there's parking in the area, not right there in front of the church, but there are a couple of garages not too far away. And we will have information at the church directing you to those garages.
Oh, super. That'll be excellent. Great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you Sunday. It's on my in my daybook and on my radar.
Thank you.
I'm going to finally make my first one.
Well, thank you for your great work and for allowing me and hosting me on this program today and for the many wonderful things you do in the community. You're really a blessing, and I appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and look forward to seeing you on Sunday. You are a blessing as well.
Thank you.
All right. You take good care.
You too. Goodbye.
All right. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye. So we are joined in the studio, Majida Rahman and Steve McCutcheon. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Wanda.
Good morning, Wanda.
Good to have you both on to talk about Black Panther History Month, and specifically the Oakland Community School Alumni Reunion 2013 and this wonderful public program that's happening at Mills College tomorrow, Saturday, October 19th from 2 to 5 in the Mills Concert Hall. It's going to be Erica Huggins is giving keynote, and she was the director of the school, you know, at the time when it was right before it closed. I don't know how long the school last week, you know, how long the school was open. You all can tell us about that. But she was, I guess, the last director. And then it's going to be Steve, you're going to give a keynote address about the history and sharing the journey, the staff experiences, which is really cool. And then there are going to be some memoir reflections, and Nomi Banks, an alumni, is going to talk about her experience as a student. So that should be really fun. And then there's going to be a reception from 5 to 7. And then for those who are alumni, there is a special get-together. You all are having a luncheon. So that should be really nice. So why don't we start with you, Majida? I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, your experience with the school. I believe you were sort of one of the founders of an aspect of the trajectory that was Oakland Community School here in Oakland, California.
Yes. When I was participating with the Black Panther Party in the late 1969, early 1970s, there were liberation schools, and I started working with a group of parents, and we developed what would become known as the Huey P. Newton Intercommunal Youth Institute. And it was a wonderful way to start a community school, because what we did was we looked at schools in Africa and schools in China and how schools were built inside of each technology department or within places where the rank-and-file members worked. So it was a school available where the parents would allow us to watch their children overnight, And then during the day, they participated in some wonderful educational activities. And then from there, I went on to be the Oakland Community School. I was not there, but I heard there were wonderful things develop. I was had the opportunity to talk to a judge, Judge Wheatley, who arrived in Oakland late. And at that time, Oakland Unified had a rule that you had to be enrolled before a certain period. And there was no school you could go to, say, after March. And people like Judge Wheatley and other famous folks were able to participate in the Oakland Community School. And from my understanding, there are some wonderful teachers out there in at Oakland Merritt College and various Oakland and Berkeley schools who are products of the Oakland Community School.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wow. Yeah, I heard that Rosa Parks came through, you know, visited the school and was really pleased with you know, with what the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was doing. And I know out of the school there were programs coming out of the school as well. The school, you know, was an actual functioning school, but when we did a tour of the school, because the building is still there on International Boulevard, Men of Valor, I believe, are the current residents of that building. But it was really wonderful being able to get a tour of the building, and that was a great program. I don't remember what year that was. Steve, what year was that?
That was 2008.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about the school and the need for an independent school at the time that the Oakland Community School was founded.
Okay. Well, the school, as previously said, the school grew out of the Oakland Community School, grew out of the Liberation School programs of the party. And when it became independent, the school became independent in 1973, became a self-sustaining model that actually was the prototype of today's charter schools. And during that time, the school had no relationship with the Oakland Unified School District, but we still utilized some of the curriculum materials that were available through the Oakland Unified School District so that the students would have some basis, the teachers and the students would have some basis that grounded the academics. Yet there were other classes also that for elementary level students that were also available, also including environmental studies, communication studies, things that were not offered in the traditional Oakland public school system.
Mm-hmm. So, what happened? Why did the school? Why isn't the school going now?
There were funding questions then at that time, and as the school relied primarily on contributions from the parents and other, other grants that help keep the school operative at the time, those fundings were no longer available to the school. So the school from 1973 to 1982 operated, and the last graduating class was in 1982. And after that point, the school was no longer able to function.
Mm-hmm. So 1982, so was the school K through 12?
No, the school was K through 6. And it was pre-K through 6. Because our younger students came from the Child Development Center, and most of those students were three and a half years of age, and they were in the preschool program, which, again, was a predecessor to today's more current preschool programs. So the Oakland Community School had both a pre-K component as well as a K-6 component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at a time when, like, the school was you know, had the most participation, how large, you know, were how many staff and how many kids in both the pre-K, like how many in the pre-K and how many in the K through 6?
Well, we had a staff, it fluctuated, but normally our staff ranged between 15 and 20 staff members, instructors and aides in the classrooms. And the school population normally stayed around 150 students.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great. So what did you teach, Steve?
The first year that I was assigned to the classroom, I was teaching science. I taught elementary science. And those were to the upper-level kids, the upper-level students. These were the equivalent of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. Then after that first year, Joe Abron and Chris Dardy were assigned to the science curriculum, and they redeveloped the school curriculum, and I was moved over into the math department. So from then on, from 1975 until I was no longer involved with the school, I taught math and physical education from grades that were primarily second through sixth graders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you also, you know, you're a martial artist and teacher, and so was that a part of your instruction as well?
That was part of the after-school component. That was the part of the Oakland Community Learning Center, which was the after-school component, which I began in 1974. And that program, eventually after the school closed, the name was changed. There became two components, one in East Oakland and one that I carried on in West Oakland, and which is now the Seven Shadows Martial Arts Association.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And is there something special happening, like a tribute, right, on Saturday, tomorrow as well?
Yes, tomorrow will mark the 40th anniversary of the Oakland Community School, and that's going to be held at Mills College. The opening ceremonies begin at 12 o'clock for Oakland Community School staff, students, and alumni, and for Oakland Community Learning Center staff and participants.
No, that's not what I meant. I meant the martial arts tribute. There's something special happening around the martial arts.
No, not tomorrow.
Oh, that's what it says. Oh, that's not true? Oh, okay.
No.
Okay, it says it on the flyer that I'm looking at. Oh, okay.
No, our reunion doesn't come up until the martial arts reunion doesn't come up until next year.
No, it says a tribute. There's a martial arts tribute.
Oh, there will be certificates issued.
Oh, okay.
And these will be honorary black belt certificates to different participants who worked closely with the martial arts program.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the staff members from the school will receive certificates as they were significant and helpful in the development and mentoring process of the martial arts program.
Yeah.
So that will just be a certificate presentation from me to those recipients.
Okay. Majida, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the 10-point program was used philosophically in the structuring or development of the schools, and then Steve, I wanted you to talk about that as well, how you know, it was like a seamless application because in the Black Panther Party for self-defense, you know, there were these basic principles, and from these basic principles grew these institutions, and the Oakland Community School and the Oakland Community Learning Center were certainly, you know, very visible institutions, but then there was also the health clinic. There was also the programs for the seniors, like the senior transport and the food giveaways. I mean, there were concrete applications connected to these principles. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that.
The ones that really struck me the most was the right to an education, the right to decent housing, clothing, food. And I think all of those issues were met during the rank and file members participating in the Black Panther Party activities. For one, there was a George Jackson Medical Clinic. There were even people working on research regarding sickle cell, which is very seldom spoke about even today. There were people working to develop shoes. There were people even taking, there was a bus where people were able to go see their loved ones in various penitentiaries, which is really needed today because you know and I know and Steve know the majority of the people that are now in the penitentiary are people of color. And really, black men and black women are also moving up into ranks in that field. But decent education is my most important platform because I see the need. I teach at Contra Costa College, and grown men and women enter my class unable to read or write, cannot do basic math. So I know that there is a problem within our community, and one of those problems is that each one, teach one, has kind of fallen off the bandwagon, and folks have went about their merry ways doing what they think is best to provide for their own family without looking at the whole picture, that if we don't get it together as a nation in terms of education, we will be the last one receiving some of the benefits of society. And, of course, those benefits are a decent job, decent wages. And the only way that you can get to that point is to have educational skills. So I've been meeting with a group of parents almost identical to what the Black Panther Party has been doing or we're doing, and that is developing another independent community school called the Nubian Academy for Girls. And it will primarily work with girls between the ages of 6 to 8 because right now, almost 18% of our young girls are dropping out of public school and charter schools because they do not feel a part of their history invested in that education. So there's a need for 100 community schools where we really spend our time educating our young girls and our young boys how to relate to society and how to bring up our skills, how to really dig in and learn math and English and be a part of this new STEM environment. And if we do not, we will be the last one with receiving those benefits.
Yeah, and Majida, people might know you for your wonderful institution, Healthy Babies Project, and where that you founded and what was it? You went for 20 years. It was a place where mothers, instead of being incarcerated, were able to live and be educated and groomed in life skills, as well as getting getting academic training while they kept their babies with them and had their babies.
Yeah, it was amazing. Project, of course, funding again intervened, but the wonderful part is I see these wonderful ladies with their children. Their children are getting out of college. The mom has returned to college. They're now getting their master's degree. A lot of these ladies went back to school and got their master's degree before I did. They encouraged me to go back to college. So it's like a lot of individuals get left and pushed off to the side for a lot of reasons. Now what we have to do, all of us, is figure out a way to bring our folks back together so that they can start developing their skills, so that they can start learning math again, so they can read and write on a level where they can get decent jobs, where they can get decent wages. But as long as, then we have to talk about racism and all that other stuff, but at least they can have a skill, and along with those skills, they can begin to, while the party was developing, and even till today, it is such a huge impact on our community worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Steve?
Still here.
Oh, I meant I wanted to get your response to the question about the impact of the 10-point program on the development of the Oakland Community School and the Oakland Community Learning Center. And you are also, you teach in the Oakland Public Schools now, so you've continued teaching. I mean, you've been in as an instructor, as a teacher, you've been involved, for a long, long time, and have a real perspective on, you know, going from, you know, an independent school, and one could even say an independent black school almost, and then looking at, you know, the school where you did a lot of your work and still do a lot of your work, that's a school that has a huge indigenous population, and you're teaching math again, you know. Or you were, anyway.
Yes. This year my subject has changed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And,
yeah.
But let me go back to the point that was the first started. When we go back to point number five of the Black Panther Party 10-point program and platform, it refers to that we want decent education for our children. And
right.
from that, the idea grew into the liberation schools. It grew into its successor, the Oakland Community School. And one thing that the dreamers of the Oakland Community School envisioned was that we did not duplicate the Oakland Community School, as the needs of black and poor children were different. And the Oakland Community Schools, or the Oakland School District and other school districts nationwide, did not account for the different learning styles of black and poor children. So as the curriculum developed at the Oakland Community School, through its staff and through its parent advisory board, we were able to structure a curriculum that involved an interaction between student, teachers, and the curriculum. So it didn't flow just from student, from teacher to student, or flow just from the curriculum to the teacher, or from the curriculum to the student, but it was an interaction that involved the curriculum topics and subjects, as well as the interaction between the students and the teachers. And this was the idea that we could move children along as they were skill-based, not necessarily age-based. So we would have children who may have been five-year-olds in a class with seven-year-olds because of their skill level. They weren't guided along or pushed along as though they were herd, a social herd, as is normally done in the public school systems here in the United States. So that idea, that practice, we were able to bring students of different ages together with similar skills so that they were able to produce at a level that they were comfortable with. And other students learned to recognize that younger students have skills that older students have, and older students learned to recognize that there were skills, that there were schoolmates and classmates who had skills that also had to be reckoned with. So the school was able to provide the guidance that students needed so that they could grow, so they could blossom and develop their academic skills and their lifelong learning skills at the same time without being pigeonholed into a particular grade or into a particular subject matter. And these are some of the things that the school emphasized, which led eventually to it receiving a state recognition, a state award that was presented in Sacramento. But the school, again, as a prototype for today's modern charter schools, those examples, they have been emulated, replicated, but not too many of the schools still have the basis, have the philosophical or the curriculum depth that the Oakland Community School staff dreamed of and was able to put into practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So of the that particular foundation, because you're still in education now, so did that make you an anomaly, among your colleagues when you were in the public school system, so to speak? Or did you meet, sort of kindred spirits, as colleagues, in the public school system where you taught for many years, as I mentioned, at the charter school that's connected to children who are indigenous okay. Populations.
The experience at the Oakland Community School and those visions, I carried with me and I still carry with me, but again, the public school systems do not are not favorable to an open a two-way flow of information between students, even though it's written into their curriculum, even in their student objectives, teaching objectives, learning objectives, but that's not the actual practice in the public school classrooms. The objectives and accountability factors in the schools call for student success based on grades and teacher accountability based on the success of their students. This was not the priority at the Oakland Community School, and in my experience with students, I have to rely on the public school curriculum, but I can approach students individually through that earlier philosophy, that early idea and vision that was obtained through the Oakland Community School. It is disappointing at this point that what students are able to achieve in school grades them based on their GPA production, mm-hmm. not on their achievement on the achievement as they move towards life rewarding and life developing skills. Their the accountability or their success measure based on just their GPA is really unfair to students who have different learning styles. And this is again going back to the idea of students being able to learn the core materials that they need to apply themselves in the real world and have an understanding of things that are occurring with them in the real world. But it is disappointing to go from the point of the Oakland Community School and have to be a part of a public school system that is set up for failure of many of its students of color.
That's really unfortunate, since so many of our children, you know, they don't have a choice with regards to alternatives to the public school system. So it's really great that, you know, Majida, that, you know, you're starting the Nubian Academy for girls. And so what kind of, I don't know, are there any ideas about maybe looking at reviving the Oakland Community School in some form, you know, whether that is like, you know, not necessarily a full-fledged school, but maybe, you know, some tutoring, a tutoring center or something like that, or support, you know, for a particular region or area where there are a lot of public schools but not a lot of support for the families. Has there been any thought about doing something like that to sort of counter the effect of the large number of black children that don't finish school, you know, that drop out for whatever reasons because they don't have that kind of support within their families or within the community that their families live in?
Okay. Wanda, to go to that point, we have to remember at the time of the Oakland Community School, there was a national organization that was responsible for the developmentation and implementation of development and implementation of that school. Those means now are not available. Most people have to approach new models of schooling now at an independent level, and so you don't have there's not the mainstream organized community interest in a particular school set of ideas that promotes that idea, that brings family and students and educators together. It's those systems don't exist at this point. They are not there to be effective at a mass level to affect many of these students of color who were just disinterested even before they leave elementary school. So there have been different pockets of people talking about the question of replicating models of the open community school, but again, without that mass community input and recognition of the failures of the public school system, then the idea is still at a dream stage at this point here. As you have some individuals and individual groups who can produce schools, open schools, along the model of the open community school, such as Hazel Mack, who was part of the New Orleans, the Winston-Salem chapter of the party. She has now opened a model of school along the lines of the open community school in Winston-Salem. Mm-hmm. There have been others who have reproduced the model of the open community school, but unless there are enough people who realize and recognize that there is a substantial injustice to children of color through the public school systems, then all these things here just become issues that people debate at school board meetings without anything effectively being done to change the conditions in the classrooms and the relationship between students, teachers, and learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I was thinking about... Go ahead,
Majida. The good news is that we do have charter schools. They're not 100%, but they're a little better than what we have been receiving. And like the 100 Black Men are opening up charter schools all over the place, and I hear those schools are doing quite well. But there's a gentleman in New York, I don't know his name, excellent schools, I understand, that he's opening up. So there are a lot of people opening up some wonderful schools to help our children. One part that's missing, the school district have cut out all the adult schools. If the adults are not getting their needs met in terms of education, just getting fed a little bit, how to read and write, some basic stuff, how to do basic math. If we don't get our adults educated so that they can in return help educate their children when they come home from whichever school, whether it's a public school or a charter school or a Panther-based school, whichever school it is, if there's no resources when those children come home, either through their parents or through a tutoring program, we are going to have a very hard time in this society. Our children and our adults have to be educated on some level. Now, that's a social scientist of me, because if the parents are not educated and they're not getting jobs, if they can't educate their children and the children are not really learning and they can't get a job, then we're really talking about poverty again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I was thinking about ASA Academy, a really wonderful school that was in West Oakland, and then the Marcus Garvey School in Los Angeles that's still going strong. And then, of course, your school, Nubian Academy for Girls, is there a way that people could Majida's gone. Oh, darn. Hopefully she'll call us back. In the meantime, Steve, I was going to mention that people can find out more about you and your work by purchasing your book, We Were Free for a While, Back to Back in the Black Panther Party, by
it's
yourself.
Still available.
Yeah, Lila Maasai. And I was actually in Tanzania, Zanzibar, so I was able to meet some Maasai people, women and men.
Okay.
So see your references.
Okay, so that. Yeah. And one other point here, Wanda, that my son and I, we're both members of the National Association of Multicultural Educators.
Oh.
And we submitted a proposal that was accepted by the conference planners, and we will co-present in November at Mission High School and in San Francisco on November the 9th, and then at the Marriott Hotel on November the 10th. So it will be a joint co-presentation with my son, who was also a student there at the Oakland Community School, and I. And as far as I know, we'll be the only father and son team that will present during that conference.
Oh, that's awesome. And what's the topic?
The topic, we have a range of topics. The two that we are going to stress is the paradigm of Black Panther Party survival programs and its relationship to multicultural education.
Hmm. Oh, that's going to be great. Okay, super. Yeah, send me the details on that so I can make sure that I list it in my column for November. But you said at Mission High School, November 9th, is that open to the public?
Right. Both sites are open to the public.
Okay.
Both of those dates. And
what time on the 9th?
On the first day of admission, I think we are scheduled to present, I think, around 4:30.
Okay.
And I don't have the time for what time we present at Marriott. We'll have more time at the Marriott event because that way the interaction will be more academic than at the San Francisco event. At the San Francisco event, we'll be basically presenting our agenda and going through the outline of ideas as how multicultural education, from the point of view where I start from the 60s and 70s, has been approached up until this point in time, and that's where my son Ashanti, he will pick up much of the new issues related to multiple education as it exists in school curriculums at this point.
Oh, that's great. So your son is also an educator?
Right. He teaches history in New York, in high school.
Wow.
in New York.
That is so wonderful. Yeah, I just look at all these alumni. Think about Raymond Nat Turner's children, and they are such leaders in the national education movement. Whatever they do, they're just leaders. That's just really phenomenal. I'm sure you could just go through a list. I mean, your son as well, you know, Ashanti McCutcheon, you know, as you know, and also a leader, and you know, setting policies that further, you know, sort of the values he learned in, you know, in the Oakland Community School, and in the household that he was founded or supported by, you know, such principles as the 10-point program. Really, really phenomenal.
So, and his whole spiel to me over the months that we've been working towards this has been since Pops, this is going to be in the Bay Area here, we have got to make a stand, make a presentation that is going to let people know about the development of multi-education through the party as an educational as well as a political vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And says, Pop, that's on you. So that's
wow.
Where it is. He threw the ball back in my court.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's really awesome. So the National Association of Multicultural Educators, November 9th
right.
and 10th in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's going to be pretty, pretty awesome. Yeah,
yes.
Maybe I can get you two of you all on the show to give us a little preview next
okay.
month.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
I know he'll be out here for a few days as
okay.
we finalize our preparations and everything. But that's what we're looking forward to for next month.
That should be great. That should really be great. So this tomorrow, October 19th, it's going to be a little teaser, huh?
That'll be actually my warm-up for next month.
That's right. Oh, that's awesome, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. Just love to have you on. It's always really great to hear your poetry, and you're going to be sharing some of your poetry tomorrow as well.
Right.
The program, so that's going to be really great. I'm sure you've written some new work, as you always
do. That's it. That's it.
What's the title of your new pieces?
Let me see. It's right here. It's Beyond the Classroom.
Beyond the Classroom.
That's the piece for tomorrow.
Okay, nice. Okay, looking forward to hearing it.
Okay. And, well, I said hopefully you can make it, and
we'll plan on coming.
Okay, then. So other than that, I'm going to leave you, Wanda. Thank you for the invitation, and thanks for the participation that we've had this morning.
Oh, thank you, Steve, for joining us, and look forward to seeing you tomorrow and hearing Beyond the Classroom.
Okay.
All right, you take good care. Congratulations on, you know, sort of the wonderful tenure, you know, of the school, of the institution, and your continuing to take the work into the world, you know, to the degree that the world is ready for it. It's really wonderful.
Okay, and like I said, and I and others, like I said, we'll do what we can.
Right.
We'll do what we can.
All right, you take good care. Have a good rest of the day.
All right, thanks, Wanda.
Sure, you're welcome. Peace and blessings. And if people are interested in finding out more about the Nubian Academy for Girls, the Oakland Post has actually run a few, I think a story, at least one story about the this new school that's in development right now that Majida Rahman told us about. So you can check the Oakland Post for more information about it, since she wasn't able to continue. Her phone call dropped, and then she wasn't able to jump to call us back. I want to play a rebroadcast of a wonderful interview with Aisha Brown regarding African American organizations making connections this year. That particular program that was really was at Laney College this year, sponsored by Keith Carson, our supervisor here in Alameda County, and Aisha talks about organizing the event, African American organizations making connections, and sort of the reason for such a gathering, and ways that people who weren't able to make it can still participate in the conversation, as Reverend Dr. Dorsey Blake talked about earlier this morning in the show about, you know, sort of the fellowship. You know, we're talking about the Howard Thurman Church, which is having its 89th anniversary this year, the Fellowship of All Peoples. You know, something about the conversation, you know, just sort of meeting but not having an opportunity to engage with the people that are present with you is sort of doesn't reinforce whatever is happening at the gathering if you don't have an opportunity to actually do some one-on-one, some conversation, break some bread together, you know, get some names, just sort of know who's in the house, who's in the room, you know, who's in the place. And we're talking about, you know, the Ma'afa ritual last week, which is really beautiful. Who's on the beach with you? Who's in the circle? And how we can connect these pieces and these parts so that we are stronger as a unit. So we think about the fellowship. So that's really important. And African American organizations making connections is a really wonderful way for African Americans to see who's making impact and how we can join each other to make an even bigger impact. So I just want to share this interview with those who weren't able to make the February 24th event or who were able to make it and just want to remind themselves that, oh, I didn't call so-and-so, or I need to follow up on blah, blah, blah. So we're going to close the show with this rebroadcast of this interview. And I want to make a couple of more announcements. What else is happening this weekend? I want to repeat that An Indian Summer, a new play by Charles Johnson, is closing this weekend. So you have an opportunity to catch it tonight at 8 o'clock and on Saturday at 8 o'clock at the Exit Theater Studio Space, 156 Eddy Street in San Francisco. And what else is happening? There's a free, San Francisco is having a free music, what is it called? It's called San Francisco Music Day Live and Free, Latin American Connections. So there are a lot of folks performing, a couple of folks that I know. I know Kierma is performing, and that's that's sort of Latin diaspora music, sort of includes poetry and with jazz and classical works. And then John Santos is performing as well, so that should be really nice. His sextet is performing, and there are just a whole lot of folks performing. And so you want to check out sffcm.org just to sort of get to know when folks are going to be performing and, you know, what time that is, what folks and what time. John Calloway and Clavi Unplugged are also performing, and I happen to know his work. So, yeah, you might want to check that out. And, there's a whole lot happening. And you can check out wandaspicks.com for a more comprehensive list. So again, we're going to end with Aisha Brown speaking about African-American organizations making connections. Oh, I knew I wanted to mention something. Mark Carey is going to be having a concert on Sunday evening at Eastside Arts Community Center. And so that's going to really be fun. They're on International. I think it's 2277 or something like that. But you can just visit eastsidearts.org to find out the details. But that's going to be really phenomenal. Mark Carey is a great composer and pianist, and he doesn't come this way often, so it's going to really be a treat, this concert. And Eastside Arts Culture Center is real intimate, and it's another place where, you know, we can have these conversations. And this one here is going to be over music. And, you know, make some more connections with people, with a community, with folks that are doing some really positive things in the San Francisco Bay Area that reverberate throughout the nation. So that's on Sunday, Mark Carey at Eastside Arts. I want to thank you, Aisha, for joining us this morning to talk about the second African-Americans Making Connections. Really enjoyed, I didn't realize it had been 3 years ago, really enjoyed the first one, and really looking forward to seeing people again and making some new connections, as well as sort of retying some knots and retying some links that maybe might have grown a little slack over the 3 years since, you know, we first decided to sort of start doing some work together, particularly around, I'm really interested in juvenile justice. Mm-hmm. And met some really cool people, like a judge and the person who's like over the young people at the juvenile prison, the newest one over on 150th. Uh-huh. Yeah, so anyway, looking forward to seeing those folks again and seeing how we can maybe keep our young people from going into those systems in the first place. And with your background in clinical psych, I'm sure, and also your work in early childhood education, I'm sure you've been really strategic and crucial with regards to getting certain people to these forums and to the table so that they can make connections with other people. So maybe we'll start with that, sort of your role in this big event, second one that we've had in 3 years, and then we'll go back and I'll share your extensive biographical preparation with our audience.
Sure, sure. Thank you, Wanda, first of all, for having our office and allowing me the opportunity to speak today with your audience and your listeners about the second African-American Organizations Making Connections event at Laney College. So we did this in 2010, and really the first attempt was really to just bring people together to learn about what was happening and have some conversations and build collaboration and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But this opportunity, we wanted to build upon that. Okay, so now we got together, we know who we are. Now let's really think about what can we do. You know, we have some time to network, and that's great and all, but now we got to roll up our sleeves. Things haven't changed. Actually, things have gotten worse. You know, our crime, and our, especially in the urban areas, in Oakland and, you know, in Richmond, you know, crime is going up, and people are kind of feeling hopeless, and we need to figure out how we, as black people, come together to make some change. We can't wait for someone to come in and save us. We really got to work together and leverage our resources and build upon that. And we're doing some great work amongst each other in all these different areas. We're doing great work in juvenile justice. We're doing great work in early education,
mm-hmm.
and in the arts, and, you know, and so we need to just figure out what strategies can we put together to help people learn how to build businesses. You know, oftentimes we come from great innovative history of people being, you know, entrepreneurs. And we need to think about how do we do that? How do we show people how to build businesses? How do we get people to talk about better communication, the basic thing, basic fundamental? How do we better communicate with our younger generation to let them know, you know, this is not acceptable or what's happening, and working together. And then dialogue between men and women. And that there are so many conversations that we need to have, we thought when we're putting this event together, how do we do that? How do we bring in a good complement of people to have those conversations? So we have people from all across different gamuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why don't you tell us about, you have like plenaries and then you have breakout sessions. It's an all-day event. It's like you mentioned, it's at Laney College, which is located at 900 Fallon Street in Oakland near the Lake Meadow BART that actually is across the street. But from 8:30 to 3, so it's a, you know, people are asked to devote a, you know, a big portion of their Saturday to this idea of making organizational connections, because, you know, we have Kwame Ture talked about how, you know, we are successful as we are able to organize, because when you organize, it means that you can repeat successes as opposed
right.
to a one-time
right.
good thing. Mm-hmm.
Right. So in the opening session, the opening plenary is really, we have Congresswoman Barbara Lee. We have former Black Panther leaders, Bobby Seale and Elaine Brown. And then we have new social justice and environmental justice leader, Jakarta Imani from Ella Baker Center, coming together, moderated by Greg Hodge,
mm-hmm.
to come together to talk about where we've been. So we, you know, talking about the successes of the Black Panther parties, the successes of our civil rights movement. And then we have a congresswoman coming, giving her lens and talking about the work that she's doing in D.C. on the more local and global and national levels. And then we have Jakarta talking about his grassroots efforts today and what's happening right now and how do we use the best practices of what happened previously that went really well,
mm-hmm.
and bring that forward. So that conversation starts at 9:30, and that's our opening session. And we hope to really kind of paint a picture of what the day looks like through that conversation and really allowing the audience to hear about some of the great things that happen here in the Bay Area. You know, the Bay Area has always been a leader about doing great work and kind of creating change. The free speech movement, the Black Panther Party, we've always been on the forefront. And so now it's time again to really think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Are there any aspects of this 2013 African-American Organizations Making Connections, and the theme is strategies and outcomes for our black community. Are there any aspects that you are really vested in, insofar as that you were the one that made sure this was in place this year? Because you've been with Supervisor Keith Carson's office for 10 years, so a very long time.
Yeah, so I work really closely with the supervisor. He and I kind of put our brains together with some of our other key staff, and we really kind of went through a process, and we just kind of weighed in on what do we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really talking about what do we want for outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured out, you know, how do we create something that actually lives beyond just that Saturday moment? That people could actually take what they learned, the information that they are getting out of those sessions, and take it on and use it and help them to build upon that, organize around it, and create change. And so that was really the intent. So Supervisor Carson and I really thought about that and just thought about the topics, because people want jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we bring experts and business owners to talk about their successes? And it's always great to have testimony from individuals who are actually in it and doing it, and not theorizing, but actually are doing it and have success in it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So then we have, like, the police chief talking about public safety, but we also have community-based organizations paired on that panel as well to talk about some of the successes and some of the ideas they use
mm-hmm.
to prevent violence and uplift the community and create safer communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember last time, besides, you know, the workshops, which I'm not certain if there are any addition, once you've got our community, a safe place, public safety, business, job creation, which you already mentioned, workforce development strategies, black health and wellness, a black community as one, intergenerational relationships, you've got faith-based and community-based organizations, and you've got black men, black women, how do we strengthen our communication.
Mm-hmm.
I remember last time that you also had Dr. Wade Nobles. He
mm-hmm.
gave a really wonderful,
mm-hmm.
it was, I think it was around lunchtime, and he gave that presentation that he's so good at, and I think, you know, maybe this is work that, you know, he is most well known for, is the whole idea of how does one claim and nurture one's humanity. How does one become human and stay human? And he talks about that from, you know, a comedic and African sensibility. And I know he's speaking again, because
mm-hmm.
I remember seeing it on another flyer, but I don't see him in what you just sent me. So
we you know, his schedule didn't permit for him to be a participant.
Oh, he's not a part of it this time.
No, he was number one on the list.
Yeah.
But his schedule didn't allow for him to actually be part of it, because, I mean, he actually, like you said, his last presentation and dialogue was really, it just had people at the edge of their chairs. You know,
mm-hmm.
people just wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that was a way to kind of bring people forward and kind of continue this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the original ways that we were kind of planning around this event, was to have him be a part of this effort.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely as we continue, because this is not just a one-day event.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a movement. This is like a call to action. And so with that said, we really need to be thinking about what happens beyond Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next steps? How are we going to help people to build businesses, to create jobs? How are we going to create better, more healthy habits within our community?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and how are we going to just be stronger in general, you know, and leverage? Because, I mean, it's just the things that are impacting our community as far as health and crime and just unemployment statistics.
Mm-hmm.
It's just off the charts, and we need to be really on a daily basis really thinking about how can we do better, and how do we not just point the finger and blame, but really figure out a way to really think better, do better, and just really empower people to want to have
mm-hmm.
to be in a better space.
Yeah. So are you going to have a plenary around the same, the lunch hour or something, and who's going to deliver that?
We're not going to have a plenary around the lunch hour. The lunch hour is going to be kind of a free opportunity, but when we come back together at the end
mm-hmm.
for closing remarks, we're going to kind of give some direction and the next steps.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the outcomes is that we're going to really develop this website
so
people can kind of begin to blog and comment about
mm-hmm.
ideas and suggestions,
mm-hmm.
and we want to continue that conversation. And then from there, we're going to convene back some working groups Mm-hmm. And really figure out what the next steps are. And so is it that we have more smaller working groups going back out on the different subjects,
mm-hmm.
and going back out and really looking at what was proposed in their groups, in their sessions, and figuring out how do we implement some of the suggestions or, you know, find out more information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from 2010, are there any outcomes that you can point to from the African American Organizations Meeting Connection that the seeds were planted, you know, in 2010, and here we are in 2013, and this particular outcome is a result of that?
Sure. So one of the things that we were able to develop was a directory.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the organizations that were either there or wanted to be part of this larger directory. And so we've been kind of keeping that alive directory of all African-American organizations, and it's very area-wide.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that was a key component that came out of the first one. And then secondly, there were a number of groups that met during the first forum that
mm-hmm.
kind of discussed particular topics and continued to meet thereafter. So there was one on art, and there was one on education that met for about a year and a half after,
mm-hmm.
and they actually were able to do some good work. One of them was with the art group. They ended up being kind of folded into what is now called the Art Murmur.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow,
so,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing.
So, yeah, some great things kind of came about. So. And so it's very interesting. So they were able to fold some of their efforts into that. And
mm-hmm.
so and then with the education, we started looking at some of the best practices and working with some of the key organizations. And like the 100 Black Men was originally part of the first one, and now some of the conversations they have helped them to catapult. So now they have a school, a community school.
Right. They sure do. It just opened this
right.
September.
Yes.
Right. Oh,
so they
wow, kind of, that is awesome.
Yeah, and I'm just saying that they were at the original, the first one, they've been part of the conversations.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to link up and meet certain key people to assist them in that journey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of keeping in mind, it's important, you know, networking and building relationships is a very integral part of how we, you know, go about and create some change.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly. And you're president of one of the oldest African-American social justice organizations, BWAPA, if you can give our audience the acronym. Tell us about, you know, what you do with that organization and its, you know, work, you know, through the African-Americans organizations making connections and anything that came out of that, you know, 10 years ago to now your organization.
So I am the chapter president for Black Women Organized for Political Action, the
mm-hmm.
Oakland Berkeley chapter, which is this organization, BWAPA, has been around for 45 years. It's the oldest women's political organization in the state of California.
Mm.
And we're celebrating our 45th year. And through this, our work, we have been able to really be out front and really advocating for policies that impact Black people. And so it started in 1968 with Dame Sordello.
Mm.
And it's been an amazing opportunity for us to really be out in front of conversations happening here in Oakland and throughout the state about different policies that are being made statewide and just different issues that are paramount to our community. And so, you know, it's really great to have some phenomenal women. It started off with 13 key women,
mm-hmm.
and then it has grown to hundreds and hundreds of women statewide.
Mm. What 13 key women did it start with?
Some of the women are like currently like our president, Desi Woods-Jones,
mm-hmm.
and Teola Sanders, Belva Davis.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so many phenomenal women. These were like the original 13 women that came together and said, this cannot continue.
Mm-hmm. What is the this that cannot continue?
Well, they weren't having a voice. It was like when they wanted to be politically engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just kind of like they weren't being allowed the opportunity to really participate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started their own organization. They started fundraising through what we know best, you know, easy ways, you know, holding fish fries, cooking, and kind of had holding conversations, and they began to raise money. And one of they held a fundraiser that was huge. And when people saw that, and they started to come and wanted to be part of the conversation that they were having, and that was just a way to get people in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And through there, they were able to really work on some policy changes across the state, but more specifically, they helped to get then City Councilperson Dellums into office to be congressman, and they helped other key elected officials in the Oakland, California area to be get elected as well.
Wow, this is all before your time.
I know. So it's like okay, do your history right, get it right.
Yeah, because you've received many awards from the East Bay Business Times, with the 40 Under 40 Leaders Award, and as a community leader in the Bay Area under age of 40, you also received the Spotlight Award from the Business Roundtable for your advocacy for businesses. So you've got your undergraduate degree in clinical psych, but then your master's degree is in organizational management. How does that come into play, in your work in the supervisor's office? And I was wondering if you could talk about, you mentioned some of the, some of the areas that, we might need to focus on, particularly, we're looking at the health of our children, health of our community, not just children, too, of course, but not just, our physical health, which is definitely is one of our challenges when we look at food security in some of our neighborhoods and communities. But also we think about, education, we look at economic development, we look at, spiritual development.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how we're doing as a district, as well as a community, because the African American organizations making connections is not just about Alameda County. It's about whoever can hear the call,
right?
And whoever can travel. And then also I want you to give information to people about how they can register. I know some deadlines have passed, but I'm sure people can still come.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's open to all. Everyone is welcome. We would love to see everyone, young and old. It's definitely an event that's catered for all ages, and we really would like to see everyone participate and come out and be part of the opening plenary session, but as well as the, some of the workshops. And so one of the things is, like, for my background, I think when I originally started in this work, I was brought on to really be a person that did, like, social services policy work.
Mm-hmm.
But everything is interconnected. And for us in our office, we have to always think about what impact do we have and how do we really are making a difference with our constituents and our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things I really love about working within this office, is because it's not just your traditional policy work. Is above and beyond. It's just not about passing legislation or passing ordinances just for the basic. It's really about how do you think about to make the quality of life better for folks, and how do we do that? And right now, like, just through as the county, we're responsible for the indigent care of the most at risk populations. We're responsible for those who cannot help themselves. We're the safety net, we're known. And so we have to really think about how do we tighten that safety net? How do we keep that safety net in place? And so that's kind of really how this event came to be, because it's about really creating change and better outcomes. So we know when we talk about unemployment, across the nation it's going down, but when you look in the real urban communities like in Oakland, we have some still really high unemployment rates, especially in the Black community. We still, our health numbers are really still really high within the Black community. Our kids are being left behind as far as education, and we're still not closing that achievement gap.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to really think about that. We have to be aware of it. First of all, people need to be aware of it. They can't think that everything is okay. Mm-hmm. We always have to be constantly in the know, looking at how do we make it better. And if it's okay, how do we make it great?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what our role is here as in county government, improving the safety net. And so that's part of part of my work on the database on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
and this event is just a piece of that.
Yeah. How do people access this directory that is one of the big products of the first African-American organizations making connections? What's the URL for that, and how do people add their organization to the list?
So in order to access the database, it's keithcarson.org.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can access that, the Making Connections database. And if people want to still register and come to the event, I encourage everyone to come out and come to the event. But the Eventbrite is still open. We encourage people to register,
mm-hmm.
because that's like really, really important for them to make sure that they register and get in, because we want to make sure that we have enough space for everybody. But all is welcome. No one is turned away,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason. I just want to make sure I give you the right URL,
mm-hmm.
when people come.
Right. Sure.
And that mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. that URL for registration is http://aamakingconnections2013.eventbrite.com.
Okay.
So people can go on and register and all are welcome. Share with your community, your friends, neighbors, church members, all.
mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I remember last time, and this is a tradition, I believe, because this is happening in February,
mm-hmm.
that you present some awards to young people, and I believe it's an oratory, right?
We're having an art contest.
Oh, it's an art contest. Okay,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so we are just kind of recognizing, we reached out to a number of different schools,
mm-hmm.
through the county, as well as some community centers, encouraged some youth to submit art, all types of form of art,
mm-hmm.
for review and kind of have a contest. And so what we got back this time, it was kind of hard to rate. So we're just going to recognize everyone that participated.
That's
and
nice.
We really got some great submissions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all ages. Okay.
Oh yeah, all ages. We got all ages.
nice. Yeah.
And the event is free. And mm-hmm. there's free lunch and free networking. And there's going to be vendors.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely, everyone should try to come out.
Yeah. So when one thinks about politics, one thinks that not much can change because. It seems like, everything is like connected to something else. I mean, the city is connected to,
mm-hmm.
the county is connected to the state government, which is connected to the federal government, and then, and everyone seems to be crying, no money, no resources, and things are getting cut, like real crucial policies that are connected to money for the more vulnerable in our communities, like the children and the elders and people that are poor and people that can't move from a neighborhood that has, schools that are not necessarily rated really high in Sacramento to a neighborhood where the schools are doing a lot better. People are just kind of stuck. And then some people don't have cars and AC transit is becoming less and less available and less affordable. Then we have BART, which mm-hmm. doesn't go everywhere. It's mm-hmm. going to the airport now, but it doesn't go everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, this high proliferation of handguns and, oh my goodness, Elaine Brown is interviewed on a Frontline special on guns, which is going to air tonight, actually, on PBS. And I'm definitely going to watch it because I didn't know that she was being interviewed. I'm like,
I didn't either.
This should be really
know.
Yeah, it's going to really be interesting. And, Frontline is, after it airs, you can actually go online and watch these programs. So it's really accessible.
Okay, good.
After that. Yeah, so just wondering just, how does one sort of maintain one's hopefulness and what brought you into this field? I mean, you could have did a whole lot of other things.
I think it was my calling. I think that, I never, prior to jumping into this role, I voted and everything, but I wasn't really, really politically engaged.
Mm.
And I think that just because of my background and what the need was originally in the office,
mm-hmm.
I think it was a good match. And I think it's just been a really phenomenal opportunity to work here and to kind of learn and to grow. And to really, I mean, I always knew I wanted to help and serve people, but I just didn't know that I would be serving and helping people through this. This way, and so this has really been a great opportunity to do that.
Yeah, because I mean, you started. I guess you started working there when you were still in school, right?
No, I was out of school. I had
You have your master's degree and everything when you started.
I had.
Oh, you're a little prodigy.
I had worked for social services for a few years prior, and worked in the social services department as a caseworker, and then came over here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that lateral?
A little bit.
Oh, that's excellent. That's really excellent.
Yeah.
So are you Alameda County native?
I am Oakland native, born and raised Oakland. I'm a Skyline High School, San Francisco State. Yeah.
Yeah. And so as you were coming up, was it, you know, your community, your family, your neighborhood that made you go into the kind of work that you are in now? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, studying clinical psych. Everyone doesn't study clinical psych.
I wanted to be a child psychologist because I wanted to work with the kids. And what happened was I did an internship, funny enough, here at the probation department while I was still in school.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of made me think, like, I don't know if I can do this because I think I'll go home crying every day. And so I knew that I couldn't save the kids that way, but what else could I do to make a difference? And so my family has really a long history of being socially and civically engaged. My grandfather used to be the fire chief for Oakland, was the first black fire chief.
Nice.
And so my grandmother used
to... tell us his name.
Samuel Golden was the first black fire chief in Oakland. And he was appointed by then Mayor Lionel Wilson.
Oh, wow. Yeah. First black mayor.
Exactly. So it was a great opportunity. So my grandmother would make us go along with her. When she had to do things, we always tagged along. And so then I didn't know. I just thought she was just making us go. But I guess it kind of stayed with me.
You mean go along with her when she was...
Because she herself would be, was really engaged. She belonged to every organization. She did a lot of community service. Anything and everything you could think of, she was doing it.
Nice.
And so she just kind of instilled that in us as her grandkids.
Nice. And then your mother and father?
My mom. My dad wasn't too much, but my mom, But it was really my grandparents that really kind of...
They were the ones that modeled the civic engagement that you are demonstrating now in your work.
Yes, definitely.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. Yeah, and then, you know, this African-American Organizations Making Connection could be coming, you know, the second meeting. Couldn't happen in a better year, you know, the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 50th anniversary of, you know, the March on Washington and I Have a Dream speech. I mean, it's just perfect. Okay, yeah, we need to, like, connect, folks.
Right, all these monumental historical moments, and now it's just really time to make some more.
Yeah.
So you really roll up our sleeves and do some work. You know what I mean?
Right. And did these anniversaries, as well as the second term for President Obama, did any of that come into play with, okay, we have to have another one of these?
You know, a little bit, but it was just really more out just looking out our doors and reading the news and just kind of working within our communities, figuring out, like, we got to do better. We got to do more. We got to do something. So I think all of that kind of came into play.
Oh, awesome, awesome. So when people register at Eventbrite, the AA Making Connections 2013.eventbrite.com, that means they'll be a part of the mailing list. And so if things happen, like maybe there's a quarterly or something, people will get notified?
Yes.
Excellent.
Definitely. We'll definitely keep them informed about the next opportunity and what's coming up next.
Well, I'm really looking forward to, you know, the second African-American Organizations Making Connections, because the first was so, it just felt so good to get together and it not be a funeral, you know?
Right.
Like, this is not a funeral. This is a celebration of what we're doing and how we can do it better, because we know other people that are, you know, supporting us and maybe doing similar things, but we didn't know them prior to this connecting or this networking opportunity that Supervisor Keith Carson is making possible, you know, through this wonderful opportunity and event on Saturday.
Yes. I'm looking, you know, I'm excited, you know, I'm excited that we're doing it again. I'm excited that, you know, that people are responding. We really have had some great responses from folks. Even a lot of young people are reaching out and saying, can I be a part of this?
Mm-hmm.
So it looks good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is. It's really, really youth-friendly. And I remember last time they had youth that were in leadership roles. Are any youth going to be leading any of these workshops?
Yes, definitely.
Which ones?
So we have actually youth paired up with mostly all of the workshops.
Oh, super. So
capacity, either they're on the panel or they're either assisting in the moderation or they're in the room monitor. In some way, we kind of paired up youth in every aspect as much as we can.
Nice. Yeah, and I remember when it was at Merritt College, the MAP program was mm-hmm. highlighted and featured. Is there anything going on at Laney that's going to be highlighted and featured at this particular event on Saturday? Since we'll be on their on their site.
Sure. So we're working with the chair of the Ethnic Studies Department,
mm-hmm.
Mika Brown.
Okay.
And so she is working with her students. She's identified about 15 to 20 students
mm-hmm.
from her various programs to come and participate in the program.
Nice.
And then of course, Dr. Nora Webb, the president of Laney College,
yes.
is engaged as well. And her staff have been phenomenal in really helping us to get this event going.
That's great. Well, I hope, you know, if you all are, like, traveling the Peralta route, I hope you come over to Alameda when you have maybe the third one.
Okay.
That'd be kind of nice. So just think about that.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you. I appreciate all of the opportunity and the time and,
mm-hmm.
you know, just for, you know, spreading the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to have to come to one of your BWAPA.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I want to join. So,
please
mm-hmm.
do.
Yeah, I definitely will. I mean, with a leader like you, oh, my goodness.
Thank you. I'm very humbled. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Aisha, for, you know, for joining us to talk about this second African American organizations making connections, which is going to just be simply fabulous, this Saturday, February 23rd, from 8:30 to 3 at Oakland's Laney College. Any particular place at Laney?
In the gymnasium. We'll be meeting. We'll be starting off in the gymnasium. We're going to have some youth come in and kind of share with us. We'll have an opening with some youth
mm-hmm.
from the Freedom School, and then and then go from there with the opening plenary session.
All right, super. And what's the phone number for this event, I should say, if people have questions and they don't want to go online?
Sure. It's 510-779-3036.
Okay.
510-779-3036.
Mm-hmm. 3036. And if people can't come but they want to be a part of the being connected, can they go on and do the Eventbrite thing?
Definitely. Go on the Eventbrite and just put your name in there. We'll keep connect anyone that registers through there. That's the kind of way to help us manage it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll definitely keep them updated what happened.
Super. Well, thank you so much for sparing us some time on your busy schedule, because it's like countdown time.
Not a problem at all. We really appreciate you supporting as you did last time and definitely this time as well.
Okay. Well, thank you again.
Thank
Look forward
Wanda.
To seeing you Saturday.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.